This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So the big question for you is, as an author, how difficult is it for you to kill off characters that you've fallen in love with over a long book series? Like, for example, The Red Wedding.
Well, you know, in the book series, there's a certain difficulty in it. But nothing I can't handle. It gets harder with the TV show because now you usually know the actor or the actress, and you're aware that not only are you killing this character, but you're putting this usually very pleasant person out of a job, and you're not going to see them anymore, and you're not going to go to parties with them anymore, like this thing. And that makes it sad, you know, in a way that just killing a character on the page is not sad. So that makes it a little more difficult. But fortunately, you know, I started writing these in 91. The first books came out, you know, more than a decade before the series started, so many of the characters were already dead in the books before we even started shooting, and I didn't have the chance to get too sentimental and say, oh no, I don't want to kill that guy, I'll keep them around.
Tyrion is great. I love Tyrion in the book, everybody does, but how surprised are you how well Peter Dinklage plays your character?
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, he was our only choice for Tyrion. Oh. We never even read anyone else. We never auditioned anyone. We just knew when we were doing it that we had to get Peter for Tyrion, and we did. So he was Tyrion even before we began here. So we knew he would hit it out of the park, and indeed he has. And he's won an Emmy and a Golden Globe, and he frankly deserves 3 or 4 more Emmys and Golden Globes.
But every actor, I mean, Daenerys, you have such a wonderful cast. I mean, it must be such a great reward that all your characters are portrayed well.
And many of them are... You know, Peter was quite a well-known actor beforehand, and we've had a few other people like Sean Bean in the first season who were established stars. But a great many of our actors are people straight out of drama school, like Emilia Clarke and Bradley West, and you know they had just academic experience, and they're coming to this as their first major professional gig. And the kids, I mean, the kids were amazing. They had done, like, school plays and things like that, and suddenly they're major international stars. And it's hard to find good kid actors. We hit it out of the park with that. Our casting director, Nina Gold, deserves all the credit for finding Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams and Isaac Hempstead Wright. Amazing actors.
And not knowing that they would grow up to be such powerful women, too. I mean, you need that transition.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
They're growing up very fast, faster than I'd like.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck tonight. I really appreciate you meeting with us. You had a lot of diverse, different type of stories this year. Nightcrawler, Whiplash. How are you feeling about how we're now getting different kinds of scripts and stories being told coming from your guild members?
Well, I'm actually very excited about that. Obviously, one of the problems that we'd always worried about is that with studio movies getting narrower and narrower, whether there'd be an outlet for people doing the kind of work that had been done for the big screen. And this year is a good example of the smaller movies actually filling that void. Television does as well, obviously. But this year in particular, there are so many very strong, smaller character-based stories, all kinds of genres, as you said, in features. That's really good for writers. It's not just a question of how many screenplays get produced, but also the variety of screenplays, because people don't all want to do the same thing.
Yeah, it seems like most of the movies that are nominated this year did not get big budgets. Guardians of the Galaxy, probably the biggest. But they're all very small indie movies. You know, like Damien is only 29 when he wrote it, Giselle with Whiplash. Do you think this also might be encouraging more writers to get into the field, knowing that maybe their stories can be heard?
Well, I hope so. Obviously, it's a period of time in which the movie business has been shrinking a little bit. Employment for movie writers, as feature writers, has gone down. So I'd hope that a year like this might encourage people to say, look, we don't all have to just do television, because there's something wonderful about this shared experience in a movie theater. So we'll see. Who knows?
But the TV is also expanding where more women are getting into writing now. I mean, you have better stats than the Directors Guild, for example. How do you feel about the women now being able to elevate to features?
Well, that's a lot of work to be done, obviously. There's not much excuse for it not just being better, but actually being roughly equal in the employment.
Should be 50-50.
Exactly. Yeah. So we are working on that. It's slow going, and it's particularly slow going in a feature business where there's fewer and fewer films being made. Hard to make some strides in making sure that underrepresented groups, women, but also writers of color, get their opportunity in features.
Thanks so much, and I look forward to tonight. Congratulations. So do you hope this win will help this very new show push on to another year? Because you never know if it's going to get renewed.
Any publicity we can get is really important. I was just telling someone in there, I started working at the show in like 2000, and I just wanted to be there for like the last year or two because I loved it. And all these years later, I'm still there, and it's still going strong. And yeah, we're very lucky, very lucky.
It's amazing. Like, it's the biggest challenge is keeping the show fresh and the characters fresh because we're in, it's been on, how many episodes are we up to now?
5,072.
So what is the biggest challenge, of doing that?
It's not repeating ourselves, keeping it fresh. We have a great showrunner, Al Jean, who does an amazing job. Matt Groening and Jim Brooks, thankfully, are still involved with the show, and they help us out. And we have a lot of writers. The original writing staff of The Simpsons was one of the greatest staffs ever, and a lot of those guys still come back and help us out. And we're just, I'm just trying not to mess it up at this point. But I love it. It's an amazing place to work.
And are we ever going to age them a little? I know it's a big question, but...
I don't think so. I don't know. That's above my pay grade. But it's Bart is just always 10. I mean, sometimes he acts more like a 12-year-old, sometimes a little bit more like an 8-year-old.
And you do the Futures episodes.
We do the Futures.
Yeah, they're always fun.
Yeah, those are great.
Is that more freeing for you as a writer? Like, oh, now we can just go out into a whole new realm.
Yeah, it's another guy who was nominated tonight, Stuart Burns, writes a lot of those, and he's just wildly creative. And because you can do anything, it's really fun to step outside the sort of constraints that we put on ourselves with the characters,
The movie shows the brutality of war amazingly. Your script. But at the same time, and that really sets up very well, of course, his post-traumatic stress at home. When you're writing the script, how did you balance the two, keep and make sure the brutality was there to set up the home life without either one, hurting each other structurally?
I tried to tell the truth in every moment and find what the deepest core of the truth was for him and for all soldiers who go through this and for their families.
Obviously, of course, the tragedy of the real-life character getting killed. How did that affect the changing of the story when you were writing it?
It was very hard. I turned in the script, and the next day, Chris was murdered. And so it was brutal. I had the benefit of his wife calling me a few days afterwards and telling me that she hoped that I could get it right because this was how her kids were going to remember their father. And so it was a huge responsibility, but it was it became an honor because she opened herself up to me and she told me everything there was to know about Chris and she revealed the other side of this warrior, the other side of this man, how big of a heart he had, and how she watched that harden and how watched the callousing of a man who comes and goes back to war again and again.
But comes back to life, through helping other soldiers, which I think is such a powerful moment in the movie. Was there anything about Bradley Cooper's portrayal that really surprised you?
Bradley just, he put on the weight and he had the accent and he mastered the guns, but the last 15 yards, he was in the red zone, but that last push towards the goal line, I don't know how he did it because he just embodied Chris in a way. He got to talk to him once. He had hundreds of hours of video, but he only got to talk to him once. But he became Chris Kyle in a way that it's really inexplicable. To Chris's friends and his family, it's been a shock.
It's a wonderful film. Congratulations, and good luck tonight. What was your biggest concern producing this film? A small movie about a music student in a conservatory with not such a nice teacher.
Of concerns. I was mostly concerned that we would have enough time to do it in the way that we wanted to, and that we did a lot in pre-production to make sure that in the 19 days we had to shoot it, we could actually get it all done. So that was the biggest issue for me. It was time.
Damien, we didn't get a chance to ask you. The change from the short film to the feature film, especially with Andrew, the different character, how did you approach that? Because you'd switch the actors and expanding his character.
I'd written the feature script first, so the short, in a way, the short was like this way of kind of figuring out how to make the full movie. It was almost like a lab experiment for us, you know, to kind of actually get to figure out how to shoot it, how to edit it in this smaller kind of construct. So it was great. It was like the rehearsal that we didn't have on the feature, in a sense.
And speaking of editing, I'm glad you brought that one up. Obviously, editing is about tempo. So did that music experience help you to get the exact right tempo from the film standpoint?
I think the guy who edited the short wound up editing the feature, Tom Cross, and so we developed this kind of shorthand doing the short. And that's the kind of relationship that was so crucial to this movie. It was all about, it needed to feel like a drummer's movie. It needed to be about rhythm. So figuring that out early on was important.
And producers, how scared were you having J.K. Simmons, the character Fletcher, because he's not a likable guy? Were you a little afraid maybe the audience would not be able to latch on to him, like they did, actually?
Actually, no, because I think that the beauty of J.K.'s performance is that he creates this real person, and he is an evil monster, but he has a consistent philosophy about his life and what he wants from it, and I think that there's something really amazing about watching him just sort of be composed in this complete way.
So, John Toubant, not the nicest man in the world. What was the biggest challenge for you guys as writers to show the humanity of him, but keep him also the villain, the balance?
Well, that was the hardest part. How did we do that? We started off and we said we don't want to make this guy a monster. So how do we do that? And I think it was done pretty well with the addition of his mother and those very few scenes. I think everybody could relate to the disapproval of a mother or a parent, and we all were able to find some sort of accessibility with that character through the mom.
Now, was there anything that Steve Carell's performance that surprised you of your scripted character?
I was, the first time I saw, we didn't spend time on set, and so the first time I saw it up there, it is absolutely astonishing how much he captured the physicality of Dupont. I mean, it's not just the makeup, the nose, but his posture, the way he trotted around the gym is precisely in the videos of John Dupont that he made of himself. It's a beautiful performance.
Of course, Channing and Mark Ruffalo, also wonderful in the film. Were their characters maybe easier to structure because they're not the villain, but also tragic, I mean, and painful?
No, I wouldn't say they were any easier. The difficulty of the movie really was finding those three characters and making them work together and making them balance so that the story worked. But we needed all three of them to do that. It was a difficult task.
For Bennett's directing, also wonderful. What did he bring to your script that really surprised you?
What did he say?
Bennett Miller bring to your script that surprised you?
Well, Bennett was involved from the very beginning. I mean, working with Max, working with me, we talked about every single scene in every draft was up for examination. So this was a multi-year project with working with Bennett from the beginning.
So that's a dream for a screenwriter to actually be included in the process instead of the usual writer writes, director takes over, and that's it.
Yes and no. It was great to work with somebody who really knew what he wanted and was able to articulate that and was very persistent and focused about what he was after. That was great.
Great. Thanks so much, and good luck tonight. All right, so obviously Alan's story is so rich and diverse, but he's also a character who's a mathematician who's antisocial. How difficult was you trying to get into his head to try to craft that character in the script?
You know, it's amazing when you're writing about someone who's one of the great geniuses of his generation, because I am not one of the great geniuses of my own, and so it sets the bar pretty high. You're writing about someone who is so much smarter than you will ever be, and so how do you get inside his mind, and how do you sort of try and conjure his mind on screen for an audience? It was a tremendous challenge, and I was very lucky that in addition to being unquestionably the greatest mathematician of his generation, Alan Turing was also a really good writer. If you go over his papers and look at his even his mathematical papers, they're quite beautiful and they're quite compelling. Like his sentences were really lovely, and you can get a sense of his voice and his personality from them. And I pored over those a lot as I started to write dialogue for him and try and figure out how he expressed himself.
Okay. There's so many powerful scenes in the movie, but there's one I just have to ask about.
Sure.
The one that struck me the most. The moment Alan realizes he's the one who's going to have to decide who lives and dies, what boat gets sunk. He's the only one that can do that. How did you approach that scene? Because that's such a wow.
Yeah, it was. I think I was always so moved by the sorts of extremely complicated moral decisions they would have had to make behind the scenes at Bletchley Park. And that scene was sort of an attempt to dramatize these decisions that were resting on the hands of these 20-year-olds. I mean, Alan Turing was 27 when he got to Bletchley Park. He had never been outside a university in his life. He was now working alongside the head of MI6 on these extremely top-level operations. We sort of talked about trying to depict all of the sort of code-breaking process as a thriller, as a mystery, because Alan would have experienced it as a thriller, because he was like literally living inside of a spy novel. And so that gave us... With every scene, the goal was always to stay true to Alan's experience, to sort of show his subjective universe in every moment of the film. How would Alan have experienced that real-life moment? How did Alan feel about it? And let's stay with him, because this is his story, and it's his film.
Did anything surprise you with Benedict's performance of your scripted character? Like, wow, I didn't expect that. Or
Every single thing about Benedict's performance surprised me. I was lucky enough to get to be in rehearsals every day and to be on set every day, so we worked very closely together. He is this actor who's always experimenting, always trying something new. I've never seen him do the same take twice. I've never seen him read a line the same way twice. Everything is just... His mind is like Alan Turing's, in that it is just constantly spinning and coming up with ideas and wanting to experiment and create. And it was a beautiful thing to watch. I think one of the hard parts, was then even in the editing process, figuring out which version to use, because he gave us so many different ideas for every moment. And he would do things, the lines that I wrote that I imagined, like, oh, that's such an angry line. He's going to scream that. He's going to say at the top of his lungs... He would whisper every one, and all the lines that I thought were so quiet and so small, he would charge ahead and dive right into. He never does what you think he's going to do, and even every moment on set, he would surprise us every day.
And that must have been a great resource for him, having you there, the writer, director, and actors collaborating together. Not normal for a feature.
No, I feel so lucky. We were such a small film. This was a $15 million independent film with kind of no big corporate infrastructure behind us. We shot it without a distributor. We shot it without a studio. So... it was just me and my friends and collaborators in London making this film. And so the director and I were very close, and the cast all got very close. And it was a wonderfully collaborative process. And that, I think, speaks so much to our director and to our producers for allowing us to just get together. And, it was an environment where if anyone has an idea, raise your hand. And anyone can speak up. Everyone should be heard from. And, for a writer on my first film, I thought that was so invaluable. And I learned something every day through that process.
I mean, really, you could make three movies about his life. I mean, and that must have been difficult too. What do you cut as a writer? What do you keep? This goes so much to the story.
It's amazing. I mean, Alan Turing in a spare weekend, developed an algorithm for determining how zebras got their stripes. Like, this is a guy who literally, not only did he invent the computer, not only did he break the Nazi Enigma code, but on a spare weekend in one of his many days off, he figured out how zebra stripes, the pattern of zebra stripes works. Like, that is a mind that is so endlessly inventing. And he came up with so many wonderful things. And the hope with a film like this is that, this isn't the last word on Alan Turing. It's that this is the first word on Alan Turing for a new audience. And so we only hope that people can see the film and then read more about this amazing man.
Thanks so much. Good luck tonight. Yep. Good luck next week. So a question for you. All right, Birdman,
yep.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yep.
We have a lot of diverse new visual storytelling styles, even Whiplash, which again nominated. But these are new directing styles. How much do you appreciate the fact that we're now seeing new voices coming into the world of directing?
I think it's incredible. I think it's exciting. And I think it's what makes these particular nominations so interesting. I had breakfast with the five feature film nominees this morning. And we were all talking about what would happen if we had exchanged scripts. If Wes Anderson had done American Sniper, what would that have looked like? what would Alejandro have done to the Grand Budapest Hotel? I mean, when you really think about it, each of them approaches the entire process of filmmaking so differently that given the same material, they would have come up with completely different films. And I think that shows you how unique they are as voices in the cinema.
Flip side, how disappointing was it that Selma didn't send out any screeners? Because if she did such a terrific job, I only wish that the Academy got to see it in the Directors Guild.
I could only say every day I went to my mailbox and looked for my Selma screener. Now, not technically, I don't actually go to my mailbox. Someone brings me mail, but I was waiting for it to come because I wasn't able to get out. I was shooting, and I wasn't able to see anything, and it was only in very few theaters, so I think it definitely hurt its possibilities by not being available to more members.
But you think the fact that the film was an amazing film, and she did a great job at such a young age, do you think that's going to maybe hope some be inspired to some younger women to maybe go into film that were scared to in the past, feeling they had no voice?
I really hope so, but sometimes you read the articles that she's given, and you see what a struggle it was to make that movie. And I hope that people go into it with their eyes wide open and think, it won't be easy. I'm going to really have to work for this like Ava did. Ava worked her ass off to get that movie made. And it didn't come together without David and everyone else sort of saying, let's make this. And then Oprah, it needed a lot of forces to come together, and she marshaled them. So if you are thinking of getting this, whether you're a woman or a man, you just got to be ready for war. It's war.
And the good news is there's some way directing nominations for women this year in TV. Exactly. So it looks like the door is cracking open for that.
Well, certainly the Guild is recognizing the work. I think they're recognizing the work and not checking off, oh, I have a woman here, I have a woman there, I have a man here. They're thinking, what's the best work? What do we like? And this year, it's 50% of the nominees in comedy and drama are women. And that just happened because that's the choices that they made as to what was the best. But if you think about it, if 50% of the nominees could be women, imagine if there are more women to choose from and more women working doing more episodes, could that be even, incredible? So I'm encouraged. It's the highest number and the highest percentage of women nominees we've had since, I think there was one other year that matched it, but it was a long time ago.
Well, thank you so much, Paris, and I will see you soon in Santa Barbara. So we're curious. Obviously, there's not a lot of video of Alan Turing. How did you go about creating the character with Benedict Cumberbatch to give his mannerisms and all the other accoutrements?
First of all, you have to start by talking to the people who remembered him. In his family, the oldest living relative was 18 when he died. So his niece. And there were others who also had remembrance of him, and those are people who worked with, and then you have all the descriptions that we sort of like of his behavior and of scenes. So you have to do it. But first of all, you have to sort of like start from the inside out. We're trying to sort of like figure out and puzzle him together. Like, how does his brain work? How do you put together this complex, man? And how does he, and from that came sort of like the mannerism, the speech, the body language. Because we feel like this guy, Alan Turing had a mind that went, in five different directions at once. He could suddenly stand talking and he just walked away. In the middle of a sentence, becomes an idea comes up, or he doesn't think you're interesting enough. It was really like a puzzle to put him together. And what was really rewarding was that when we showed the movie to his family, afterwards. I know, but Benedict and me was really nervous about it. And they show it, and then his niece, who was 18 when he died, walked over to Benedict and said, you made my uncle come back alive. I mean, this is how I remembered him. So that was extremely meaningful.
One scene, a lot of your scenes really hit me emotionally, but one scene really got me was the scene where Alan has to make the decision to who lives and dies, what ships get sunk, that kind of burden of responsibility. How did you approach that scene? Because it was such a pivotal and...
This is about a man, which is also true. I mean, this is Alan Turing was 27 when he came to Bletchley. And he was a man who's always been sort of like a loner. He sort of like didn't care about other people. And then now he came into this and become part of this unit, this group of, and they become like friends. And he got engaged with Joan, and he bonded with these people. And then comes the whole process of pushing them away. This man who takes more and more responsibility, more and more secrets is being layered on him. And it's almost like this great sadness. But it's sort of like he's hardening up in his mind. So and I think Ben's performance is so wonderful there. And it is actually shocking now to everything they did to try and keep this a secret. It's remarkable. All these double. I mean, the Navy didn't know that they cracked it. Their own bloody Navy. It's the military. There was not, and they even sent Alan Turing to New York to lie to what later became CIA, because the Americans wanted to know how far they went, and they sent to Alan Turing, and they actually said to him, "You don't have to lie so much. Just explain how your machine works a little bit, because it's so complex that nobody really gets it." So, but that's a true story. We tried to get it into the film, but we wasn't able to fit it in. But it's so much the story.
Oh, thank you so much, and good luck tonight and the Oscars.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.